Meeting. This is an open essay meeting with a panel. This meeting is being recorded. Personal audio and visual recordings are not permitted. Please take a moment and silence all mobile devices. Would the meeting leader or other essay member please read what is a sexaholic or what is sexual sobriety? Do we have any of that? From the essay white book. Anybody have an essay white book? Oh, okay, go ahead.
We're not to walk over. I'm Scott, sexaholic.
Hi, Scott.
What is a sexaholic and what is sexual sobriety? We can only speak for ourselves. The specialized nature of Sexaholics Anonymous can best be understood in terms of what we call the sexaholic. The sexaholic has taken himself or herself out of the whole context of what is right or wrong. He or she has lost control, no longer has the power of choice, and is not free to stop. Lust has become an addiction. Our situation is like that of the alcoholic who can no longer tolerate alcohol and must stop drinking altogether, but is hooked and cannot stop. So it is with the sexaholic or sex drunk who can no longer tolerate lust but cannot stop. Thus, for the sexaholic, any form of sex with oneself or with partners other than the spouse is progressively addictive and destructive. We also see that lust is the driving force behind our sexual acting out, and true sobriety includes progressive victory over lust. These conclusions were forced upon us in the crucible of our experiences and recovery. We have no other options. But we have found that acceptance of these facts is the key to a happy and joyous freedom we could otherwise never know. This will and should discourage many inquirers who admit to sexual obsession or compulsion, but who simply want to control and enjoy it, much as the alcoholic would like to control and enjoy drinking. Until we had been driven to the point of despair, until we really wanted to stop but could not, we did not give ourselves to this program of recovery. Sexaholics Anonymous is for those who know they have no other option but to stop, and their own enlightened self-interest must tell them this.
Thank you, Scott.
Thanks, Scott.
Okay. Because our common welfare comes first, here are the guidelines for this meeting. The panel members will each share their experience, strength, and hope for 2 minutes. At that time, written questions for the panel from the audience will be asked for by the moderator. Questions are to be written on the cards provided, please. Additional cards are available on the back table as well. Please do not bring question cards to the panelist table. Simply raise them up and a volunteer will come and collect the cards and bring them to the front throughout the meeting. Questions will be screened for appropriateness and asked anonymously. Questions will be addressed to the panel as a whole and not directed toward a specific panelist. Panel members are not experts and do not speak for or represent SNN as a whole. Rather, they're sharing their own personal experiences as related to the questions being asked. Would the first panelist please introduce herself?
Hi, my name is Andrea. I'm in SNN.
Andrea.
Hi. I'll share a little bit from Reflections of Hope just to get my story started because it really resonates. And I change it a little bit, the first sentence. But growing up, I never knew my father. I think I compensated for my hunger of love by trying desperately to please the men that I dated, hoping to gain their love. It seemed to me that sex was the core of experiencing intimacy with a man, the most important sign of love. I thought if I were sexually active and did what these men wanted, I would in turn have my emotional needs met. Eventually, I married a sexaholic and thankfully entered the doors of SNN. And that is basically my childhood of origin. I think that's what they call it. And I have only my experience to share, not much strength and a little bit of hope. I met my qualifier in high school. We dated for 7 years, and the whole time God was poking me and telling me that things weren't right. But I felt very lucky to have been chosen by my qualifier. And so I suppressed a lot of the things that felt wrong, and I ignored the red flags. and I eventually got married. And a big part of the decision thinking, or I don't know what was going on in my head, was the fear of disappointing the people around me if I didn't get married, because everything was paid for, invitations were out, you know, all that kind of stuff. And I just thought, everybody's going to be so disappointed in me if I don't do this. And also, I was still at the point of, maybe I can fix him. Maybe this will cure things. Maybe I can change all this, you know. So it didn't work. And discovered 2 months in some pretty serious stuff. And we have been physically separated, not living together anymore ever since. And I lived a lie for a long time of being a happy newlywed. And so when I came into Essanon, I thought, you know, nobody's going to have a story like mine. Nobody's going to understand. And lo and behold, there are many of us. we don't have a timer. Okay, I'm just going to end it there. That's kind of where I'm at right now. but thank you for listening.
Thanks, Andrea.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Elise. I'm very, very grateful, Essanon. I entered the doors of Essanon in 2019, and I had a pretty unremarkable, happy childhood. There was no addiction or anything. I didn't even know really what addiction was, and I was pretty sheltered and whatever. I did have an emotionally kind of not nurturing mom. She did the best she could, but I think that when 3 out of 3 of us married addicts and came from a family of no addiction, there was something there to be said. And I met I kind of dated some people that were on a piece of paper absolutely so wrong for me, and then met my husband when we were both in graduate school. It was one of those things that when we started dating, kaboom, that was it. It was just this, we were both really pretty innocent and inexperienced with regard to relationships and that type of thing, and really just felt that he was my Prince Charming. I was living in Disneyland and everything was great. And we moved a couple times job related wise, had 3 boys and wound up in San Diego. And D-Day happened 2016, actually, after a woman and her 4 kids had been living in our house while she was going through a divorce. And a month after she moved out, I found texts between my husband and her. And it took the course of 3.5 years in total to get 9 different rock bottoms and to find out that there had been multiple women, many of which I thought were my friends, that would look at me, that would smile, that would use me, it was horrible. And really just kept hitting rock bottom. And I don't know that I would say suicidal, like I wanted to actively do something. I just wanted to go to sleep and I didn't want to wake up because being awake was way too painful. And 2.5 years after discovery is when we found program, and it was a year after that was the full disclosure. And so that's why I say 3.5 years, 9 rock bottoms, it was awful. But from the day I walked into Essanon, I found my people. And whether these people out there that are in Essanon were the ones that were physically in the room or not doesn't matter. You represent those people that were there for me to catch me when I couldn't catch myself. And I had nothing to give anybody when I walked in those rooms. All I could do was take. And I took, and I swore to myself, if I ever, ever got through this, I would spend the rest of my life giving back to this program that truly has saved my life. So I thank Essanon. I thank the SAs here for being brave enough to do the hard work, and thank you.
Thank you, Elise.
Apparently we got 2 of them.
There it is, a grateful, very grateful Essanon. I was married 27 years, thought I had a great marriage, 2 kids, life was good. And then my husband disclosed what was going on in his life that I didn't know about. Had a lot invested in that relationship, and so I did go home that night and write a list of what I wanted in the divorce. But that was just, you know, I needed to do that. In that moment, I needed to do that. I also, you know, as I like to say, God bless Google, I knew I wasn't the only one. I knew there had to be something out there. I didn't know what it was, but I found, being the perfect codependent, I found everything that my partner needed to do, and I also found Essanon. And so 10 or 12 days later, I was at my first Essanon meeting, and I knew that was for me. I grew up in a chaotic household, not with addiction, but my mom had grown up with addiction, and so she brought her nonism to raising me. I learned everything I know, you know, at her knee, basically. And my dad was a sort of a rageaholic, so it was crazy. It was an addictive household. It was not an addictive household, but it was a crazy place to grow up, and I couldn't wait to get out of Dodge. And so I was this, like, strong, independent woman. I owned my own home. I was working. I was taking care of myself. Met this wonderful man who was the polar opposite of my dad. He was so calm, so easygoing, so laid back. And earlier in someone's share, they talked about she was a talker and I wasn't. And that is exactly was our relationship at the beginning. I will say we talked on the phone for hours, but I talked on the phone for hours. And he listened and maybe said, uh-huh, every once in a while, I'm guessing. So it was, you know, it was a great relationship, I thought. And I think we both thought. We were a great team together. And what this program has done for me, and I believe for our relationship, is made it even better. Helped me to become the person I want to be, not the person I was before that was so troubled and so struggling and so anxious and so worried. And oh, good, I get to stop there. Now I'm not all those things, and I'm much more comfortable in my own skin. So thank you very much.
Hi, I'm Naomi. I'm a grateful Essanon. Okay, how did I get here? Well, first off, I was married to a sexaholic, and he was rager, so in order to save my life, I ended up walking away from that relationship, but it didn't bring me to Essanon because I didn't know it even existed. And the thing that eventually brought me here was that I spent 17 years dating sexaholics. I picked so many of them. There were the homosexuals, there was the guys that were lying to me, the ones that had the brilliant ideas that after I get married, this will magically stop, you know, all of that kind of stuff. And then I met somebody. I was actually set up on a blind date, and I asked him all of the questions. Do you have problems with this? Oh, yeah, well, I'll answer that on our fifth date. And he did. And on our fifth date, he let me know that he was a member of Sexaholics Anonymous, and he had a couple of years of sobriety, and I decided that I liked that much better than the other ones, which had just sprang it on me, either by me discovering it or just outright telling. And loved that, and he kept telling me that I needed to come to Essanon. And I came to my first Essanon meeting, and I was like, I don't know if I belong here. But the more I listened, the more I realized that, no, I pick people that cannot or will not love and support me in a healthy way. I am an Essanon through and through. I qualify. I have siblings that either are SA or are married to SA. I have, I probably have a child that's probably belongs in SA as well. We'll find out. I guess the only membership for free becoming a member of SA is a desire to become sober. So when that child decides to join, then I'll know. Anyway, I'm very grateful to be here. I am learning so much. I have so much peace. I've been blessed with the gift of friends. I have people to call, and I have a way of giving back what I've been given. Thank you for letting me share.
Thanks, Naomi. Okay. Pardon my ignorance here, but how are we going to work this? Are you going to hand the cards out and I pick
them
up?
We already did. We're picking them out.
Oh, God. Makes my job so easy. I'm glad you're here. Yeah. All right, here we go. So I'm getting schooled. Thank you. Okay, first question. I'm a single sexaholic. Why would a woman want to marry me? Again? Okay. I am a single sexaholic. Why would a woman want to marry me?
I'm Yvonne, and I'll be happy to start with that one. What I have learned in my time in this program is that my darling husband is a well-rounded, multifaceted human being, like me and like everyone in this room. He's a wonderful father, a wonderful grandfather. He was a great employee and a great boss. Brother, son, on and on and on and on. And mixed in there, he's also an addict. But that's just a part, and a small part, I would say, of who he is. So that's why. If someone can see past, oh my God, you know, there's this thing, and look to the whole person, I think everyone, I don't believe personally there's anyone on the planet who doesn't have some sort of baggage. So that would be my answer. Thanks.
As someone who has married a sexaholic, I will just say the honesty was everything, because he took me aside and he waited until I got to know whether or not we were going to go on the sixth date. Then he let me know, and he was honest, and he gave me the space I needed between date 5 and date 6 to process and decide I'd rather be married or continue to be in a relationship with someone who is telling me the truth than somebody who's trying to hide it underneath the rug and keep it from me.
I think I would answer that question by saying that I don't think an alcoholic's problem is alcohol, and I don't think a drug addict's problem is drugs, and I don't think a sex addict's problem is sex. I think it's all a way of numbing out from an internal void, this big hole that's inside all of us on both sides of the equation that's missing. And the only thing that can fill that is really not even sobriety. The opposite of addiction is not sobriety, it's connection. And my feeling is even the fact that whoever asked that question is in these rooms trying to get healthy and trying to learn what is the appropriate thing to fill up that void inside of me, you're already 10 steps ahead of the game for 99% of other people out there in the world. So taking this program seriously and learning to have a relationship with your higher power, I think you won't have any trouble.
Okay. Thanks, Lisa. All the good stuff's been said. But I will say honesty is a big one, and the fact that you're here is a big one. When I was debating whether or not to get married, I knew that there was a problem. I knew that there was a sexaholic problem. The problem is that there wasn't honesty about the extent. And so I would really emphasize being honest about what it looks like for you.
Thanks, Andrea.
Okay, let's move to the next question. What's the basic Essanon literature? What is the basic Essanon literature.
The first book I got was The Blue Book and Reflections of Hope. Is that the answer?
I think the answer is we use three books mostly. The Blue Book, which is
the 12 Steps of Essanon, the Green Book, which is Working the Essanon Program, and then Reflections of Hope, which is our daily reader.
Okay, I think that answers the question pretty straightforward. Next question. Does Essanon offer sexual sobriety? Good question. Does Essanon offer sexual sobriety?
How about that? What
does that mean?
I don't either.
Essanon is not... It's Essanon is a program for those of us who are have friends or relatives with a problem of sex addiction. It has nothing to do with our sex lives or our sexual sobriety, whatever that is. We offer, hopefully, serenity and emotional sobriety.
Naomi here. It does have, in the Green Book, a chapter called Defining Our Emotional Sobriety. So the only thing we offer is you get to write your own definition of sobriety.
Can I move on to the next question, please? How does forgiveness factor into your recovery? How does forgiveness factor into your recovery?
I think that there's a saying that says, how free do you want to be? And I look at holding on to resentment as I think about it as bricks in my backpack. And I am carrying around all these heavy bricks in my backpack. And I keep drinking the poison, waiting for other people to die, whether it's job-related or partner-related or kids-related or the next or neighbor-related. It doesn't matter. When I'm focused on other people, they don't even know how aggravated I am. So it's all about how free do you want to be. And letting go of some of those bricks is super-duper freeing. And I think also, in intensive step work, going through step four and realizing that I too am a flawed person. I am not the perfect person I thought I was when I came into program, and I have my own work that I need to do, and in order for me to be able to forgive anybody, I have to first learn to forgive myself, and that was huge for me.
I'm Naomi. I have the one thing that I was always frustrated with my first husband about was he'd say, forgive me. When he didn't ask me to forgive him, he wanted me to trust him. And there is a difference. And that's one of those things that I had to learn for myself. There is a difference between forgiveness and trust. And for me, just like Ali said, it's just all about me letting go of my desire to wish him dead. And I am now free to live my life and let go of all of that stuff that's happened in the past and move forward.
Don't move off of that, because I got a follow-up. What does regaining trust look like?
Well, let me tell you a little bit about trust. Trust is one little thing. It's all about you have to work. There is no timeline. There is no set, you will be trusted in exactly 90 days. That doesn't exist. So you just have to crush that up, throw it in the fire, burn it. There is no timeline. You earn it one day at a time. You say, I will be home at 5 o'clock, and you're home at 5. You say, I will be at the store, you're at store. You say you're going to be at work, you're at work. It's just all about you do what you say, you mean what you say, and then everyone can see that you are trustworthy.
I think for me, forgiveness is similar to what has been shared, that it's when I am running around holding resentments about anything, It's just poison in my blood. And so forgiveness is for me. And sometimes it happens just automatically. I'm like, do I really want to be living in resentment? And I have to let go of something or whatever. I think for me, I would say I understand. I have come through program to understand what my husband did and the whys of what my husband did. And I've learned that it has absolutely nothing to do with me. It has absolutely nothing to do with me. It's not about me, it's not at me, it's not to me. It's his illness, and I have to work on me. And so for me, that's what, it's just not going there. It's a sort of a living amends for me, forgiveness. It's not a, oh my God, honey, I forgive you. It's just, I have to let go and move on and live my life. What was
this? Trust.
Trust. And I'm old. Trust. Trust is a fascinating one. Yes, I've heard again and again, new people say, my husband says, when am I ever going to trust him again? It's like, he doesn't get to ask that question. Sorry, all SAs in the room. You don't actually get to ask that question. Well, you can, but the answer is just show it. Show it. Earn it. Do it. Live it. Be a trustworthy human being, and maybe the people in your life will trust you again. That's, you don't get any control over that. That may be harsh, but it's the reality. And I think, and I hopefully have said this in your presence before, I think I have. I trust my husband with my life. I trust him with a lot of things. Do I trust him 100% like I did before program? No. I know there are things that might happen. Okay. But I trust him in the ways that, for me, are important to the relationship. I am no angel either, and I think that's what's helped me get here. Is like, I have my little slice of the pie that is not very good, right? I'm all these other things. And so I trust him for the important stuff, and that's what matters for me.
Thanks, Yvonne.
Thanks, Yvonne.
I heard that love is a verb, and love is not a noun. And so love to me is something that you're doing. It's actions. And I used to very easily fall prey to believing words, whether words were written, whether words were spoken. It didn't matter, and I would so easily fall into my fairy tale world about how beautiful the words were. And now I'm trying to tune out words and watch for actions, and it could be such little stupid things. The garbage can is full, and all of a sudden, when my husband notices that and takes out the trash, and it's bonus points when he actually puts a new bag in there, but we'll go there later. No, he hasn't either, but that's okay. That's okay. I'm so impressed that he even like notices. To me, what that says inside of me is we're a team. This is our house together. We both filled up the trash can, and we both noticed that it's such stupid things like that. And I think if you guys realized how simple it was to regain trust, those little things, being where you say you're going to be, etc., but little things he does, like planning our vacations. And I don't enjoy making the flight and hotel and whatever. He loves doing it, and he does a beautiful job at it. And I know it's done with love. And sometimes, like, I'll make him something. It doesn't matter. He'll go to Starbucks and get a scone. Sometimes I'll make them at home, and I'll say, well, did you like them? Yeah, they're fine. And I go, no, the reason they're good is, what were they made with? And he goes, they're made with love. So, I mean, I think that when the garbage is taken out with love, when things are made with love, that those things, they come through. When I see him now open with the kids and talking with the kids and being present and being part of the family, those to me, that's the fairy tale world that I thought that I was marrying into.
Asha, really fast, on trust first, doing what you'll say you'll do, which was previously shared, very important, and honesty, even when it's hard and especially when it's hard. That builds trust for me. And on forgiveness, I think the question kind of framed it as forgiveness as a part of recovery. And for me, I wouldn't have been able to wait for forgiveness to emerge to start recovery, which I think kind of makes sense because it's through program, it's through recovery that I've been able to learn what forgiveness is, what it looks like, how it applies to me and things like that. But it was acceptance and acknowledgement that came first. So yeah, that's my take on those.
Thank you. When it comes to rebuilding trust, what is most important to you? Give it a shot. What do you need from your qualifier to help rebuild trust?
It's honesty, y'all.
Part one. Part one. And part one. How do you feel you start to heal and focus on your own recovery rather than your qualifier's addiction? Okay.
Oh, it says, what helped you to start to heal and focus on your own recovery rather than on your qualifier's addiction? Walking into a meeting.
Oh boy. For me, I think it was just acknowledging that I am worthy of love. I am lovable. I am enough.
I think that question about focusing on my own recovery, and I'm definitely a work in progress because I really do still slide to the other side of the street, and I try to recognize it, and I think I'm recognizing it faster, but the saying that if I'm not the problem, there is no solution. And so when I spend all of my time thinking about his or anybody else's issues and what they need to be doing to do something better, I stay in this world of step one of unmanageability. I'm literally like a hamster on a hamster wheel or on a merry-go-round that just won't turn off. And I started to feel empowered when I realized that I was part of the problem, because only then was there something I could do about it. And when the rest of the world was my problem, and if only they would change, they talk about it in the big book on like page 68 or something like that, talking about wanting to be the actor, you know, devising the whole play, and if only the lights were here and the ballet was here, and if everybody would just know that I had the best way of doing things and do things my way, the play would be great, kind of thing. But realizing that it just doesn't work that way. So when I am able to focus on staying in my own lane, I put the emphasis on myself, and I'm a work in progress, so not there.
As was previously shared, meetings really helped me get to this place, because I was kind of expecting this was my perception, us gal pals to get together and like hate on the boys, right? You know, we were all hurt, things like that. But when I got to the rooms, we were talking about sexaholic, we were talking about ourselves, and focusing on me was, I wrote it in the past tense, but I'm gonna put is. Focusing on me is scary. Makes me realize all the character defects that I brought to the table. Makes me realize the role I played in making my reality. One of my favorite things that I received from program is, if you spot it, you got it. And I spotted a lot of it. which means that I got a lot. I got a lot to work on. but it was only through meetings that I was able to get to that place of realization.
Okay, let's juggle it up a little bit. Let's go to a different question. This from an SA member. Do I have the right to ask you for forgiveness as your qualifier, or is that only for you to give at your discretion when and if you are ever ready? Ooh, it's a good thing they don't put their name on this.
You got that?
Okay, I'll try it again. All right. Do I have the right to ask you for forgiveness as your qualifier, or is that only for you to give at your discretion when and if you are ever ready?
I think it's like a yes and. You do have the right to ask for my forgiveness as my qualifier, but it is up to me to be in a place to give you that when and if I'm ever ready. Yes and yes.
What was your greatest obstacle? Oh, wait a second. Oh, okay. What was your greatest obstacle to entering Essanon? And how did you overcome that obstacle? Let me say it again. Okay, good.
Mine was absolute, complete, and utter fear. First of all, I had never even heard of SA or Essanon, and our dates of entering program were about, I don't know what they think, 11 days apart or something. And so when I found out there was some kind of support group for me, I wanted to go, but I was so afraid of the world after having been burned by so many people that I was really afraid of running into different people anywhere. And I had the person that answered the phone as my angel the first time meet me in the parking lot and literally hold my hand and walk into the meeting and sit down next to me and just hug me while I cried through the whole meeting. So that would have been the only obstacle, and once I had gone to one meeting, I was fine with it.
I'm Naomi. I think for me, my barrier was the fact that I didn't have the problem. It wasn't my problem. Why do I need to go to a group to get over somebody else's problem? It's not mine. So it took me, I had to come once and find out that was not the truth. In reality, it's like Elise said, a support group. It's for people who have been affected by the sexaholic behavior. And that changed my perspective entirely.
I'm Yvonne again. I'm going to take a slightly different tack to this. I had no problem going to my first meeting. My problem was committing to going regularly. I went to a couple different meetings, and then I found my home meeting, which is on a Saturday afternoon at 4:30. So you can imagine, we're running errands, or we're going out to dinner with friends, or we're, some event or whatever. There were so many reasons that I just, I can't go this week, no big deal. But I had the best teacher, my husband, and this is how it felt, abandoned me every Monday night to go talk to a group of strangers, and he wasn't talking to me. And I finally said, wait a minute, he doesn't let anything get in the way of that meeting. And so I started making sure that if we were going to dinner with people, it was at 7. If we were running errands, we got home by 4. Whatever it was, my barrier was committing. But once I paid attention to what was going on around me, I went, I got this. I can make this a priority. And I had complete and total support. It was my insecurity that kept me away from the meeting and my not feeling worthy, that I'm not important enough to reschedule this thing or whatever it was. Thanks.
Ladies, first of all, I'd just like to say thank you for being so honest and so brave. I couldn't do it. In the context of rebuilding intimacy, what were some ways to show love and affection without triggering trauma? I'm going to say that again slowly. In the context of rebuilding intimacy, what were, are some ways to show love and affection without triggering trauma?
We just came from a couples meeting this morning at 10:15 in this very room on intimacy. and the basic, what I take away from it and what I, is that intimacy is emotional intimacy, it's spiritual intimacy, it's connection, it's lots and lots of things. And physical, sexual intimacy, which it sounds like this question is about, perhaps, I don't know, is kind of last on the list. That when, you know, we've heard this weekend, sex is optional, right? The rebuilding of intimacy is not about, at least for me, not about sex. It's about communication and connection. And we've worked on that a lot, my partner and I. So I hope that answers whoever asked that question.
For me, I think rebuilding intimacy without causing any trauma is just taking the actions of love. Just take the actions of love. Take out the trash. Turn off the lights, you know, maybe do a load of laundry. Sit next to me when I'm watching TV. The silliest things, you know, maybe sit up and actually face me, put the phone down and talk to me face to face. It's amazing how just that connection. Find what my love language is. You never know. If my love language is a gift of service, I might fall over my feet with just a breakfast in bed. Thank you. If it's something like touch, I might just love it if you just rub your fingers right across my back as you walk past. Just acknowledge that I have a body and I'm alive. You know, something simple. Find out what my love language is.
I think we probably started to build the best intimacy during a period of abstinence. And it was the craziest thing because I associated intimacy with sex. And when sex was off the table for whatever the time period was, we learned to just hold hands. And even the way that we would hold hands became so completely different. I would ask questions before about, were you wearing your wedding ring when this kind of a thing? And so in my mind, that wedding ring had no significance. Well, all of a sudden when we were holding hands and he'd be twirling my ring around or holding or kissing my ring or something, that had a whole new intimacy to it that had nothing to do with sex. It was coming by and rubbing my back when he didn't used to ever want to do anything to give, and it was those little acts of loving kindness like that, the rubbing my back, rubbing my head, coming in the door and just kissing the top of my head kind of a thing. And the acronym that I really love for sex is the spiritual energy exchange. And it just, when the other pieces of intimacy get to that point, the physical happens when two hearts are kind of together. And it's not even something that has to be thought about. It just happens. And that to me is that organic, beautiful intimacy that probably was what I was longing for the whole time, and I suspect he was too.
Next question is, please share about your journey into acceptance of sexaholism as a disease.
I'll start with this one. I think it's in coming to these meetings and being able to hear other sexaholic speaking, that I could hear about their traumatic childhood. I could see them stand up here and cry and be emotional and remorseful, that I realized that there was a broken little boy or girl inside of each of those addicts. And when I was finally able to accept that my husband did not ask for his childhood, he did not ask for the trauma that happened, he did not ask to be that scared little boy who started out hiding because it was a character asset. And nobody told him the day he turned 18, you don't need that character asset. You don't have to hide and suck your thumb or masturbate or whatever the thing is that was numbing out. You don't have to do that anymore and shut that light switch off. It was a habit that had formed that was there to protect him. And there was nothing magical that came in to say, you don't need that anymore. And understanding that he didn't ask for any of this, and I can just see sometimes that broken little boy that needs a hug more than me yelling at him or talking down to him or shaming him, and understanding that he didn't want any of this. He's sick and not bad.
Oh, I'll just add, my qualifier and I both come from broken homes. And so I thought that two broken people could come together and make a whole. That's not how it works. I know. So, well, now I know. Coming to acceptance was by learning about what I knew they were both broken and I didn't know to what extent. And I can say that I've even learned about the severity of the brokenness in my own home. I would have never thought I'd ever be in a place of not blaming my mom, but acknowledging the truth about the behavior that my mom brought into the home. You know, a single mother doing her best. I was always giving her the benefit of the doubt. But because of program, I'm able to look at my own childhood and see parts of it for what they were, truly. And so acceptance for my qualifier's behavior as a sexaholic was only achieved by learning about the parts of the childhood that I did not know about. And that was through honest conversation that didn't happen before. And I know that that was only achieved through program.
In the Keys to S&N Recovery, which the meeting I went to, we read every week, it says, number one, sexaholism is a disease very similar, to alcoholism. At first, many of us could not accept this idea. For S&N members, it means that we see sexaholics as sick people, not bad people. They are powerless over lust. Sorry, I meant to put my phone away, not the mic. I heard that every week, every meeting I went to. Sexaholics are sick people, not bad people. It was drilled into my head. And then I had to realize and put it into action, and I started, you know, understanding as I went to more and more meetings and as we started coming to conventions, and I heard the story from other sexaholics and heard, you know, all the different stories from other folks on the other side of the street, and started to understand when my husband told me his story, what it meant, and that it took a while. I want to say it took a while. There was a lot of pieces of that puzzle to put together. But when I was able to put it all together, it made a huge difference. And it got me to that place when I talk about it, it's not about me. That is a piece of that experience and that lesson. Thanks.
I fell for the media when the media told me that all of these sexaholics out there and their behavior was bad, and he did it on purpose to hurt the significant others in his life. And so I had to rewrite a lot of the the inner dialogue in my brain about the fact that, okay, it's not about me. It's not about whether or not I am the right shape, have the right color hair, or wear the right color of clothes. It's not even about whether or not I have that special bag or the Prada shoes or whatever. It's all about him. It's in their head. It's what they're thinking, and it's got nothing to do with how I look or what I'm acting like. On the other hand, I could contribute to it, but I don't need to. And so I'm now loving this new way of life, and I do like the key. Thank you.
We've got 4 minutes left, and I've got a great little question for you guys. How do you practice conscious contact with your higher power? How do you practice conscious contact with your higher power? I've been dealing with this for 2 days.
All right. I can jump right in because that's easy. I sit in bed with the lights on, and I just close my eyes and sit still. And I have a little timer that says, okay, you're going to sit here and you're going to be still and you're going to ask God to give you whatever inspiration you need to receive for the next 30 minutes.
I think for me, it's not such a conscious, act, but it for me, it's that I have slowed down and allowed the pause, allowed myself to take space and not have to, everything is not a snap decision. I don't have to know everything. I can actually slow down and let the answer come. Let my brain or my higher power sift through the options and send down the right one or the one that makes the most sense for me. And the concept of acceptance, that I just have to allow what happens to happen. And not try to control it and manage it and all that stuff. I think for me, that is my connection with my higher power.
Prayer for me is really important when I'm trying to maintain conscious contact with God. I was in a meeting earlier today and someone shared a prayer that they'd actually written. And I just immediately felt the presence and closeness of my higher power that I choose to call God. And it was kind of a super cool experience that I wasn't really expecting to experience in that meeting. So it was just a reminder that God is always around me, but I can especially feel it when I'm praying and asking for that reminder of the contact. So that was pretty cool. And then it also can be about a place for me, particularly when I'm at church. I feel close to my higher power, but that's not always accessible to me, and prayer always is.
I think this is a super hard one for me, but I think that the closest thing I can do to answer is realizing that nothing, absolutely nothing, happens in God's world by mistake. And when things are really troubling me, I challenge myself to say, what if, instead of this situation happening to me, what if it happened for me? What is my lesson? What am I supposed to be learning from this? I think that's probably the closest I get to realizing that there's a plan out there, and I just have to figure out what that is.
Well, everybody, that's all the time we have for our meeting. And please join me in thanking these wonderful people, for the courage, the strength, and the experience. Now, I'd like to divert from this. I'd like us all to just stand and say the acceptance prayer. Oh, do we do acceptance prayer here? No. Okay, how about the serenity prayer?
Perfect.
All right. You do the acceptance prayer?
Yeah.
Oh, cool.
Man, I don't know anything about S&I. And acceptance is the answer to all my problems today. When I'm disturbed, it's because I find some person, place, thing, or situation, some fact of my life unacceptable to me, and I can find no serenity until I accept that person, place, thing, or situation as being exactly the way it's supposed to be at this moment. Nothing, absolutely nothing, happens in God's world by mistake. Until I can accept my sexaholism, I cannot stay sober. Unless I accept life completely on life terms, I cannot be happy. I need to concentrate, not so much on what needs to be changed in the world, as what needs to be changed in me and my attitudes. My words might have been different because I'm in the SA and not an S&I. I'm sorry.